You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Michael Bazette. Michael, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Michael, I know we're going to talk about writing, upcoming books, and you'll be reading today. But to begin with, where are you, or what's happening in your practice? We're talking December 17th. It's 2020. We seem to be peaking in the pandemic now. Or who knows? But how has this affected your writing, and where are you right now, just to get a snapshot of what's going on for you now?
Well, I am... That's a good kind of big question. There's so much that's happening right now that feels kind of outside of language and bigger than language. I'm in Minneapolis, you know, at a northern latitude, so this is a pretty hibernatory time anyway, you know, as we're moving into solstice. But it feels even more, you know, in the hunkering down mode, I would say. And the writing has been slow, really, since the pandemic started. But because I'm also a translator, I've actually been turning my thoughts to that a little bit, just trying to get inside someone else's language and their words and their rhythms and cadences, and sometimes that can get things moving a little bit for me.
So let's talk about that. There's the first piece you're going to read is translation, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah. It's from my translation of the Popol Vuh, which is the it's the Mayan creation myth. It's kind of a creation epic because it's sort of like the world is being created, and then that creation story is interrupted by what essentially is like a heroic epic where two hero twins journey to the underworld and have to set things right there. So essentially that the creation of the world can continue and become complete. Mm. The section I was going to read is called, it's from quite early in the text, it's called The Beginning, when the world is created, but human beings have not yet appeared. The Beginning. Here we are, all is still. All is still silent and waiting. All is silent and calm. Hushed and empty is the womb of the sky. These are the first words. This is the first speaking. There is not yet one person, one animal, bird, fish, crab, tree, rock, hollow, canyon, field. The broad sky is all alone. The face of the earth is not yet here. The expanse of sea is all alone, along with the womb of the sky. Nothing has been gathered. All is at rest. Nothing stirs. All is drowsing. Nothing stands. Only the breath of water. Only the tranquil sea. There is no thought of what might be. All lies dark and silent in the only night. Then came the word. Heart of sky arrived in the dark of the only night. Heart of sky arrived with sovereign and Quetzal serpent. The gods talked together then. They pondered and wondered. They reached an accord, braiding together their words and their thoughts. They heartened one another, and it came clear. The conception of humans born beneath a luminous sky. Then they conceived the generations of trees and the generations of thickets. The germination of all life in the darkness of pale dawn by Heart of Sky, who is also called Hurricane. Lightning Hurricane is first, newborn thunderbolt second, sudden lightning is third. These three as one are Heart of Sky. They came together with Sovereign and Quetzal Serpent. Their joining conceived both light and life. How shall it be sown? When should dawn come? Who will feed these worlds? Who will sustain them? Let it be like this, they said. Let the water clear away so the plate of earth comes toward the light. Let the land gather and level out. Then it can be sown. Then the dawn can come. But there will be no words of praise or prayer to sing of what we frame and shape until humanity is born, until true people have been made, they said. When it was time to make the earth, it only took a word. to make earth, they said, earth. And there it was, sudden as a cloud or mist unfolds from the face of a mountain. So earth was there.
Thank you. Thank you. That's beautiful and fascinating, really, this creation myth, because as you said, it's also, we're a few days away from the solstice here, and you know, I don't know a lot about those kind of myths, but I am reading a book of kind of short stories about things that are similar in terms of creation and light from all over the world that has something to do with just about this time of the year, the 21st, the solstice. And it seems like there's so much in there also about this, about the light, you know. I mean, I in a way, I have a hard time kind of digesting even the stories I'm reading now, because it's extremely abstract, right? The writer is talking about imagining a world that doesn't exist.
Exactly. Well, one of the things I love about the Mayan approach, say, in contrast to Genesis, is that it opens, it's in the present tense for, most of its telling, so that every time the story is told, you're kind of in the eternal now of the narrative, and, you know, creation is continuous and unfolding, and it's not yet complete. You know, that's stemming from the oral tradition, but I think it's wonderful. Here we are, all is still, you know. And as such, it brings an immediacy that I really like as well. But you're right to be thinking of solstice, because what's interesting is that the hero twins I mentioned, at the end of their kind of epic arc, their apotheosis, they become the sun and the moon, and there are actually moments where the moon hero twin kind of has to step up, moments of eclipse. At one point, the hero twin who becomes the sun is decapitated and has to be sort of saved and supported by the moon. Light is so crucial to the Mayans.
See, that's such a fascinating story. I mean, what you just said there in a sentence is kind of sounds like such a complex story, yet I imagine in some ways this tale, this story, this poem is meant to teach, right? These stories are meant to teach somehow. Just in the sense of what creation is or how we all got here, but something we can use now that has to do with I'm not sure, self-knowledge or something like that?
Well, you know, and they really presage what it is that is going to make human beings fully human, because there are some failed creation attempts on the way there, where it's a final iteration, you know, people have arms and legs, they can eat, they can speak, but they are not able to use language in a way that mirrors back with intelligence and gratitude where they come from. And so those humans are essentially reduced to being monkeys. And so when they're saying, you know, we need humans to mirror back their origins with words of praise and prayer and also precision, you know, to make earth, they said earth, sudden as a mist or cloud unfolds from a mountain. So, you know, the earth was there. The power of language, again, I think it links to the oral tradition, but you're right, the teaching that occurs in that, especially around the fact that language and narrative are how we hold our cultural DNA and pass it from generation to generation, and thus, you know, wisdom can accumulate.
Fascinating. So let's hear another poem. What are you reading from next?
Well, I just had a little book come out called The Temple, where it was kind of interesting. I have been a long fascinated. The opening of the book, the epigraph for it, is the quote by W.S. Merwin that's been one of my favorites forever, where he simply states, "If you find you no longer believe, enlarge the temple." And, you know, these last 4 years in particular, I've been thinking, you know, what do we actually believe in? What's worth believing in? But also sort of contemplating the idea of the body as a temple. And walking the little body of my dog every morning, who gets me out into the cold and the snow, and sometimes outside of language. Probably the best thing I can do to circle back to your first question in terms of the writing is usually go on a long walk. So this is just a poem about what it's like to share life with an animal, the gentle reminding, you know, that he offers. It's called A Confession. When my dog started rewriting my poems, they got better. They suddenly possessed the ineffable whiff of multivalent scents, milked from the breeze by a wet black nose, the ear-flopping joy of open car windows, the quivering willingness to lick the ones you barely know but sense that you might one day love. The squirrel imagery grew more pungent, more necessary. The piercing musk of unbathed human flesh rose sharp as wine intermingled with uncured salami. And when the pages closed at last, you only had to follow the circle of your own steps before collapsing into an untroubled sleep.
Thank you. I love that. Yeah, I'm smiling a lot. That's quite a counterpoint to the first one. And so nice to read. Yeah, so crowded in a way. And so tell me more about this book. I know you're going to read another from a forthcoming book, but let's talk a little bit more about this book that you
just read. I was raised Catholic and went to Catholic schools for 12 or 13 years, you know, so in some ways I guess I consider myself a secular Catholic. And I think that idea of that kind of imprints on someone where there is another world just beyond this one, and you have to pay attention and sort of look for little signs of it. And the fact that the world we see is an illusion, and there's something, you know, greater beyond it, was really interesting kind of accidental training in terms of becoming a poet. My wife, who's also a writer, but who was just, you know, kind of raised in a purely secular way by, you know, hippies in the 60s and 70s, sometimes reminisces or kind of marvels at that, how useful it is to have this structural framework of belief to sometimes just push against or to offer something to disagree with. I had rarely written about belief, I guess, so directly, just because we don't really trust words like belief or faith or soul, particularly in the academy. And, you know, I suddenly found myself just a few years ago circling back and thinking about these stories as stories that I was raised inside. Things like Cain and Abel, you know, it's such a strange story to think about God pitting two brothers against one another and then choosing one over the other. And to think that that wouldn't result in some form of violence or disruption on a certain level. Or the story of Lazarus. I remember as a kid having the illustrated, you know, gospel story. And there was an illustration actually from the point of view of Lazarus, you know, kind of his mummified arms reaching out. And I thought, God, how terrifying that must have been. I always had these counter-interpretations, you know, as a child that didn't finally find footing until I got to revisit them and you know, sometimes rewrite them. And so that's in some ways what the temple was about.
Yeah, and I love that idea, that quote at the beginning of, you know, expanding the temple. It is an unusual time in history, right? And especially, like you were saying, in academic circles, the idea of soul, belief, things like this are dismissed, right? I'm just interviewing an artist who, you know, taught at Yale for a while. She taught at Barnard, incredibly acclaimed artist, and you know, won the Guggenheim and all kinds of things. And she was saying how she's very interested in alchemy and mysticism and was saying how, you know, that's just absolutely taboo in the art world. She said, for example, imagine I painted a large painting of the Virgin Mary. She said, just, you know, unacceptable, really, unacceptable. And she attributed it to a certain group of theorists, but it's also something in our culture, right, that faith, that ideas of exploring things through mythology and stories is still a bit taboo, even after Joseph Campbell and people like that.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And yet, I think, you know, arguably the thing that separates us from other, like, high-order social primates is our ability to really live inside of narrative, you know. Mm-hmm. And so much of the divide today, I'd say in our current moment politically, comes from people just inhabiting mutually exclusive narratives, and even self-reinforcing through different modes of social media and whatnot, where we're all in our little echo chambers, and those narratives can become just kind of reified and ossified even, and just get kind of rigid and self-reinforcing.
No, that's fascinating, right? They're self-reinforced and they're mutually exclusive with others, which, yeah, is kind of the opposite of what mythology and the kind of narratives that we're somewhat discussing is about, right? It's kind of the opposite.
Yes.
So you're going to read one more poem. Sorry, go on.
Yeah.
I don't want to stop you. But is that something you were always thinking about, you said?
Well, I mean, the next book, the next poem I'm going to read is from my book coming out from Milkweed in 2021, next year. And at its center, it's called The Echo Chamber. And at its center, it has a retelling. I went back to Ovid of the myth of Echo and Narcissus because I just found myself thinking about it endlessly, you know, over these last few years and really wanted to refract kind of our current cracked cultural moment through the lens of that story, both in elements of like the disappearance of Echo, the erasure of her voice, the idea of echo chambers, but coupled with kind of the narcissism that's just sort of embedded somewhat in the individuality of American culture. And it was really fun to sort of shift gears and go to some Mediterranean myths and retell them. But this poem is going to be the first in the collection. And it's called History. And it was inspired by a poem by Jameson Fitzpatrick. History. The vinegar tang of a glass of wine left out on the counter overnight. The hint of cumin on your fingertips. Dried lavender. All this is the smell of you in summer, and now it is history. I woke alone and slid my legs into the twin flannel tunnels of my sweats, and it was history. I walked down to the 7-Eleven for a big gulp in lieu of coffee, and this ill-considered choice was history. The sweet syrup in the mix had never seen a cane plantation. It was born of corn, which is what the ancient Mayans said the first people were made of. And yes, this too was history, is history. Our ability to take a moment here to quibble over verb tenses is a consequence, swollen fat as a paperback, some thoughtless person left out in the rain of history. The melodramatic line breaks in this poem are history, both the relatively justified length of line and the use of the word justified to suggest things come out even in the end, are history. And the head fake back there, the first stanza, where you thought this might be about the end of a relationship but discovered otherwise, is history, as is your inclination to continue trusting me. Because the fact that I can take the time to write this all down, considering what to include and what to leave out, as I tap keys that were injection molded out of a blend of thermoplastics by distant people I will never have to think of again, is one definition of history. One definition, not the first, and not the last.
Thank you. That was I love that poem. Let's talk about this. This is from the forthcoming book, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, so when is that coming out? And, I mean, there'll be links here so people can get your books, learn more about it. But if you want to mention when that's coming out, we can discuss
it. It's coming out in October of 2021. And as I mentioned, it has, a retelling of the myth of Echo and Narcissus at its center. One thing I didn't like when I was a kid and a student and beginning to read poems as if they would contain classical allusions to stories that I didn't know without sort of giving me enough context. So I thought since right. I was going to be thinking about echo chambers and American narcissism that it would be good to have a retelling of the story, but with selfie culture included, you know, which is such a perfect, apt metaphor. And it dips into other elements. I think there's a poem, a retelling of what happened inside the Trojan horse, you know, taking something so corrupted and bringing it into the very heart of the temple, and thinking about the choices the American people have made, you know, in the last 4 to 8 to 10 to 12 to 16 years in terms of what we've brought into, you know, our quote, sacred democracy. And also just thinking about late-stage capitalism, which I think has so much to do with reinforcing that echo chamber because it kind of feeds off of it and profits from it. Those are the things that were just kind of preoccupying me as I was writing a lot of these poems.
And when will that book come out?
It'll be out in the fall of 2021, early October, I believe.
2021. Okay, thanks so much. I have one more question to ask you, Michael, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
Right now, I'm reading a number of things. I'm deeply enjoying Flights by Olga Tokarczuk. I'm rereading the Ficciones, the collected fictions of Borges, because I'm teaching a course in Latin American Lit, and enjoying those immensely as well. And I've also been reading the poetry of Liesl Mueller, which I've just recently kind of rediscovered and found to be perfect for the pandemic in some strange way.
Michael, thanks so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate your work and wish you well on the coming books.
Thanks so much for having me, Brainerd. I really enjoyed our conversation.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.